Malcolm Hoenlein is with us. It's weekly update time, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Mr. Hoenlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Appreciate that. Lots going on in the political scene. Let's start with the choice of the Democratic nominee, Vice President Harris, nominating her vice president, the governor of Minnesota. Sometimes with governors, Malcolm, as you know, it's not like members of Congress. It's not like members of the House or senators. Often there's no record when it comes to foreign policy. What do we know about the policy positions of great interest to the Jewish community about this Democratic vice president nominee?
Well, there are a lot of reports. There are people, obviously, in the Jewish community there who knew him well. They remember that he came out in defense of Israel. I think he even lowered the flagstaff after the attacks in Israel South, against Israel South. And he was a member of Congress. He seems to have been a pretty good pro-Israel record. It seems that as governor he moved more to the left on issues. He did resist pressure from SJP. In fact, threw him out of a meeting or refused a meeting with them. So there are positive involvements on his part in regard to Israel, and it seems to the directly to the Jewish community. But as I said, the trend in his domestic agenda was towards the left. But again, it's, you know, the vice presidential role gets exaggerated because it's the president who makes decisions. And, you know, look at Mike Pence, look at others who came in. And very rare instances are the vice president's really critical decision to the decision-making process.
Yeah, understood. And we all know that. But in this case, it was the one who didn't become the vice president nominee that may have gotten more attention than the one who did. Many feel that a choice of Governor Shapiro would have won the state of Pennsylvania automatically for Vice President Harris. And then, of course, there were two major factors that were cited. I don't know if either of them are true, but I'd love your opinion about it. One was that he simply would have outshone her in terms of the personality, in terms of his popularity, a stronger presence on stage than she would have been. That's number one. And of course, the second, they were worried about his positions on Israel, satisfying certain segments of the Democratic Party. What's your reaction to him being snubbed?
Well, he's a very attractive candidate. I've met him. He's very articulate. He has a strong Jewish background. He keeps the governor mansion is kosher. He sends his kids to Jewish schools. So he's had a long Jewish identity and pro-Israel identity. But, you know, he was, even before Schumer, he issued a very critical statement about Prime Minister Netanyahu. And so there was concern about the direction in which he has been headed. It's true that he's declared himself a Zionist. He had a Israeli-themed bar mitzvah, which they bring up. I mean, it's just ludicrous what the extent to which they go and how quickly they moved against him as a candidate. He has been openly associated with Israel. He's visited. He's, as I said, his personal practices are clear, and I'm sure that concerned that element of the Democratic Party or those who are trying to influence it from the extreme anti-Israel elements. And the very fact that his Jewishness became a debate issue, if you remember Lieberman's candidacy, if you remember there were others who were considered at times, the vehemence of the reaction, I think, is more of an indicator of the time of the anti-Israel and anti-Jewish elements and sentiments that exist, and the continuing rise of anti-Semitic incidents. I mean, we break records every month, every year, and it's not just in Europe and not just in Canada. I'm talking about here in the United States. So the debate, the nature of that debate discussion, what criteria were used, whether the points you raised, he is a very strong candidate, it's quite obviously much more came across in that opening event, more than the governor did from Minnesota. But I don't have insight into what the final decision was. But it is concerning that even this debate takes place, that this is the criteria that, that may have been suggested.
In other U.S. political news, in Missouri, Cori Bush has been unseated. There will be somebody else running on the Democratic side in the general election in that district. She did proceed to make it clear that those who are responsible for her defeat have now radicalized her, and she said, "AIPAC, I'm coming to tear down your kingdom." And she said it in a much more aggressive tone than I just did. What was your reaction to that threat by Cori Bush?
Well, the very fact that she talks about becoming radicalized, I don't know, you know, it's like forcing herself off the edge of the earth. I mean, she was pretty radical before. She was as anti-Israel as you could be. And she was vulnerable. And it's true that there was a big infusion of funds against her. And thank God she was defeated and beaten by a Black, a very qualified person that nobody, you know, focuses on the fact that her constituency rejected her. You can pour in 10 times the amount of money that was poured in. But if she wasn't unacceptable to her constituents, she would have won. They were attempts against others. It doesn't work in and of itself. It has to be there where you get the message across, where I think the local Jewish community mobilized and turned out. But I think the rest of the community recognized that she doesn't serve their purpose. She doesn't advocate for them. She is and there is more pro-Israel sentiment in many places than people believe. They don't want somebody who hates Israel, except for, you know, for the SJP and that element, and unfortunately on the far left, to that very strong and increasing number. But I think that her defeat has great symbolism. It certainly has to be a reminder coming after the defeat of Bowman that two of the members of the Squid have lost, and are and the others are certainly going to become more aggressive in their own defense, but it's a sign of their fear and their weakness, and they would have been vulnerable. I think AOC, if you remember, got elected with 10% of the vote came right. out. Nobody right. showed up.
Right.
And so it's not because they're wildly popular.
No, yeah, I get that. In general, I'm asking you this from an analyst point of view, because I'm not asking you for inside workings that you might know about AIPAC. But in general, AIPAC, it seems, has made a decision. It seems this way. For those of us who follow closely, it seems they've made a decision not to go after certain squad members that they think are undefeatable. Is that AIPAC's general MO, that they'll only really act and become aggressive both in fundraising and influence when they feel that someone is ripe for the taking? Or could they, you know, look at Ilhan Omar and others and say to themselves that, you know, it's worth at least a battle to try to unseat her?
Well, as you know, AIPAC has been moving more and more towards becoming an actual PAC. They were never a PAC,
right.
They were a public affairs committee, not a political action committee, which raises money and can spend money for candidates. So they made a decision that they were better off and more impactful, and that is where the game was in terms of helping in Congress, et cetera, not giving up on the agenda of legislative advocacy, but as you can see, pouring and creating a fund with tens and tens of millions of dollars and giving a vehicle for Jews and non-Jews who care about this agenda to be able to contribute and to go after them on the battleground, where you let the facts speak, but you expose what the media generally does not expose and doesn't want to tell the side of the story or is afraid to. You're right that they do pick their targets, because, first of all, I think it's important in the beginning, especially, that you win. It doesn't mean you have to win every race, and it right. doesn't mean that you don't go after somebody just in order to inform the constituency about what their positions are. But Ilhan Omar was vulnerable at the last time. I think she won by 1%. But this time, the setup was different in terms of people running against her. That means, though, that in the future, they can pick other targets. You can't pick so many where you have to invest. I think they put $9 million, they admitted to or acknowledged, into that race, Cori Bush. And I'm sure there were many others who donated money. So you have to pick your slots. But the message is what's important to the members and to the world, that being anti-Israel is not what the American people want today, and it's still not. And the polls still show. Yeah, I just saw a study that 70% of the students on campus reject these demonstrations and stuff. 70? That's not the image.
That's nationwide?
Yes.
Wow.
And that tells you a different story than the image one would get from, and it means that a lot of the rest may not have any opinion they certainly don't support this as the primary agenda. It's under 5% that say that this is the issue. Gaza was a, primary motivator in what decisions they made, how they vote, et cetera. It's not the image you would get. So the numbers, the reality on the ground, unfortunately, it's the squeaky wheel, and that wheel is growing, that the number of people, and we will see it this September on the campuses. We already know, we've seen some of the plans that they have. And they have PFLP doing training. As you know, the money has been traced from China and paying for these demonstrations, supporting them, aside from the extremists in America, in addition to the billions that Qatar has poured onto the campuses. We will see it at the Democratic Convention, where they were granted a mile-long demonstration route, and they're demanding a two-mile-long route. They have tens of thousands of people coming to Chicago. They keep talking about replicating 1968, for those who are old enough to remember 1968, like you. And I don't want to in any sense diminish. We are facing a serious threat. There's a new threat on the campus, which I just want to alert people to, that we've just discovered in recent days, where they are instructing the anti-Israel elements that they should file complaints with universities against Jewish students for anti-Palestinian, anti-Islamic, Islamophobic remarks, whatever, even if they didn't exist, but just to harass them and to tie them down. I mean, then the students have to lawyer up, because the universities then initiate investigations, and the most innocent people will then be subject to this, to having to have the expense or the bother, and have to focus on defending themselves against baseless charges, which is very hard to do. And, they will always be get somebody else who of their own group who will say, yes, we heard it, and they did it. It's a new tactic. It even has an initial for it. But we're seeing much more aggressive things. But we have to keep it in context and not be dissuaded from sustaining our activity or depressed. It is not a happy situation. I'm very worried about the trend in America. We're going to surpass 5,000 or 6,000 anti-Semitic incidents here. And it's Canada, by the way, has a similar number this year, even though it's a much smaller community. It's a very troublesome trend, but we have to remain strong and committed and not let them dissuade us from it, depress us from doing what we have to do.
Well, the enemy is very creative. That's interesting what you said about how things are going to operate on the campus, the added element for this coming school year. That's amazing. And I guess the resignation, they were suspended, but now the resignation of the three administrators at Columbia, I guess, does indicate, as you said, that I didn't realize it was 70%, but there's still, thank God, a significant percentage of those who are against these activities and don't tolerate when people send texts that are against the campus Jewish community, etc. By the way, in terms of the governor of Minnesota, there's a video, and I know videos have to be in context, and I get the whole thing, believe me, that's a topic that we could talk about forever, but there is a video of him really paying tribute to Ilhan Omar. So you think that was just a single, political grandstanding event where he had no choice but to welcome her in what he felt was an appropriate fashion? Or does that trouble you that a video and an event like that exists?
No, I don't think it was a singular event. I think that he did it on numerous occasions, and there's a lot of pictures of him with her and saying, thank God we have her in the Congress, and how that uplifts him. I meant to mention it before. I was saying that it's a mixed picture on him,
right.
But the focus on him is it's more the symbolism, and because of the contrast with Shapiro, and again Shapiro is highly critical of Netanyahu on a personal level. But his the reference you're making is not a one time occasion, and he really goes to very far extremes in praising Omar.
All right, lots to be concerned about, but after all, that's what it's all about, checking out the news and deciding what to be concerned about. Should we be concerned that, according to the New York Times, the vice president of the United States, the presumptive nominee, is considering an arms embargo to Israel, or at least it's in the conversation?
So there was a meeting, and the SJP and the people reported afterwards that she said she would consider, or I don't think she committed to, but she would consider it. She now denies it completely. And other people were there say that she did not. But the party and the campaign has completely repudiated that and said, and she has said that it's not her position and she would not consider an arms embargo against Israel. I think that the reaction to it was so overwhelming. And, you know, the campaign has a tendency. I mean, there's been no real debate and no real opportunities for in-depth interviews where these positions get enumerated. Hopefully, in the debates, and there'll be occasions where there'll be further clarification. But they have repudiated it. But you know that she has been very critical of Netanyahu, and everybody cites, of course, that she didn't come to the speech and nor to advance. But she would be seated in the important position right behind the prime minister. This particular issue really caught people's imagination and attention, I should say, and they did move a couple of days later to repudiate it completely.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and, of course, on the beloved NSN app. Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, weekly update on this Erev Shabbos Chazon. Reminder, Tisha B'Av is Monday night and Tuesday. Speaking of the U.S., do you think it's the United States' presence in the Middle East, which seems to be getting more and more larger as the days go by? Is it that has prevented a full-scale retaliation? Remember, there is a retaliation. There's still plenty of rockets coming from the proxies of Iran to our brothers and sisters in Israel. But do you think that the massive promised major escalation has been prevented by the United States presence in the Middle East?
I think there are a number of factors that are at play. It could be that they just postponed it because they weren't ready, and we have seen some movement of missiles into place, but a lot of what would be deemed to be preparatory moves for a massive strike have not yet been completed, and some are not even yet in evidence. People in Tehran sent me pictures after the first day of anti-aircraft batteries that were placed in Tehran, so it almost seemed as if then they were doing it, and now it has slowed down. You know, the Russians have now made several deals with Iran, including supplying more advanced missiles and supposedly selling them jets. They're making deals on the sanctions evasion. Iran is, you know, helping Russia sell the oil. They're selling them drones and the material for the war in Ukraine. And you have the emergence of the China, North Korea, Russia, Iran axis working together. I think the presence of the U.S. fleet in the CENTCOM, by the way, the head of CENTCOM arrived in Israel again today, the second time in a week that he's there, Kirilis, and he has been amazing. The CENTCOM support generally has been amazing, because you know they moved aircraft carriers. We have a lot of resources in the Red Sea and in Mediterranean area that I think it is a very critical factor. Is it enough to stop a retaliation? No. Do they fire almost every day? There are, today included, drones that have gone as far as Akko, attack drones from Hezbollah. They admitted that they were going towards a base. the rockets continue to come in very large numbers, and unfortunately are doing a lot of damage. They say half the houses in Metula have been damaged and many destroyed. You know, you don't read about it, you don't see it. I've talked about the vineyards and all the other impact that, again, day to day, people don't get notice of. But you have 80,000 Israelis who have displaced. You saw what happened to the Druze community. And I spoke yesterday to the sheikh who leads the community in the Golan, and he was so reassertive of his commitment to Israel.
Wow.
And that community, you know, they serve in the IDF very courageously. There have been some who were killed in Gaza. You know, people don't know because it's sort of a mysterious community, the Druze. They don't know if it's just somebody who mispronounced Jews, but it's not. It's a completely separate community. And they are also, there's a large community in Syria who are more pro-Israel. There's a large community in Lebanon who are more pro-Hezbollah, maybe because they have to. They were very upset about the attack and the killing of the 12 Jewish children at the soccer field. So, number one, the capacity of Hezbollah is still very great. Israel has eliminated more and more of the leaders. These pinpoint strikes, when you hear that four people are taken out, it's not just four people. They're all commanders. They've eliminated many in the leadership ranks, and they can't replace them that fast. People say, well, does it matter if you take out Haniyeh? And it doesn't, because they still have Sinwar. You take out Sinwar, that is important. Removing Haniyeh, though, is a very important blow. It is a symbolic message of being able to, that the long arm can reach them wherever they are. And whoever did it, and however it was done, it had certainly had a big impact.
Now that Sinwar has been promoted to Haniyeh's position, do you think that he's taking extra caution?
He can't take more cautions. He doesn't emerge anywhere out of his round hole. he is surrounded supposedly by hostages are being held with him. Whether he gets smuggled in and out, we don't know. I believe that he's still in Gaza from all the people I've spoken to. But I think it's important that people, that for the world that tries to show that Haniyeh was a moderate, you see what the real, who's in real control, that Sinwar takes over, and it's almost a singular leadership of Hamas, and there is pressure for negotiations. Israel has accepted the call to negotiate. We'll see whether they do and what conditions they place on the negotiations now with Sinwar at the head. He was against it. You know, he also, Haniyeh, was engaged in the discussions in Beijing where they sort of reached an accord or some sort of accommodation with Abbas, right, and that right. They would merge. And
well, frankly,
Sinwar was very much against it.
Frankly, with all the news from this week that you just described, it's hard to believe that a hostage deal or a ceasefire and hostage deal would be back on the table. Yet we keep reading, as you just pointed out, that, you know, that whole process is being accelerated. Is it again a timing thing? Is this President Biden trying to make sure that because of his own legacy, et cetera, you know, before Election Day or before January 20th, he gets this deal done?
I mean, that's always a factor in people's minds. I think there are people in the administration who are just committed to getting a ceasefire, that they don't want to see it spread. There are many people in Israel who want to see a ceasefire, and there's good reason to argue that we don't want more death and destruction. On the other hand, we have not yet wiped out in Gaza the Hamas presence. You saw they uncovered a 3-kilometer tunnel just last night. They are discovering more and more of the, stockpiling of weapons. And Hamas has not been eliminated. A lot of the leadership has. Israel's been living up to the pressure of pinpointing it and not having widespread destruction and casualties. You don't read every day the figures now because the numbers are limited. They give advance warning, which means the terrorists also can get out, but they've been doing a very effective job in eliminating a lot of the key operatives and finding the tunnels and finding the destruction. And of course, what they found on the Philadelphia route, still discovering more tunnels that go into Egypt. So they can't give it up. And Israel will have to have the right to be able to go back in and when rockets are fired, as they have been consistently, to be able to go and get after the source of it, et cetera. So those are things which Sumar will reject. It's not going to be an easy negotiation. It's not going to walk into a pre-cooked meal. The fact that the Qatar and Egypt and U.S. issued the joint appeal, I think Israel was right to say yes, because otherwise everybody will say they're the obstacle. But let's see what they're ready to bring to the table.
Some of these tunnels, by the way, including the one this week, they literally could drive vehicles through.
There were several where you could drive. The one that you're talking about is the one on the Philadelphia route going into Egypt. You could drive trucks through. This one that they found was big enough for a small car, and certainly for them to transport weapons and other things. And you see how much was invested in all of these dozens of tunnels just on the Philadelphia route, let alone all the miles and miles and miles, hundreds of miles of underground tunnels. And you see what Israel was fighting and how they were able, they go from house to house. They would attack from a civilian house, knowing Israel would be reluctant to strike back. And they found it today, and they punch holes through the things to go, be able to go into the next house. So they fire, run into the other house, but use the human shields to prevent Israel or limit Israel's response, or to raise the death toll, because they don't care. I mean, they don't care how many Gazans die. Even of their own people.
Assuming this news item is accurate, why would Putin advise the leadership of Iran to maintain a restrained response to the assassinations?
For one thing, you know, now they have investments there. They are selling them weapons. They don't want to see something happen that could escalate out of control and they lose the export of their oil, which is going through to bypass the sanctions. Iran is exporting through Iran.
Is that enough, by the way? Is that enough for the citizens of Israel to depend on, that if Putin, he's influential enough that he could actually keep them from a full-scale response? I mean, is that enough for people to, could people sleep at night in most areas of Israel because they know that the main power behind Iran is strongly recommending that they calm down?
First of all, you never know with the Russians what they perceive their particular interests. If they think that an all-out war will weaken America's position, will advance theirs, will build their coalition, then they will do it. But right now, I think Putin, who is selling more advanced weapons, including missiles and planes to Russia, but it says that they can't be used against civilians. Well, that's ridiculous. That's a great PR point, but it's not a reality that they could contain them and not going to be able to use them or hit civilian populations, that they only can be used against military targets or responses. But their interest, I mean, is in sustaining, number one, the supply of weapons from Iran, the export of their oil to Iran, and that Iran pay for the weapons that they're getting. China, as you notice, has been relatively quiet in all of this, although you have Chinese ships in the area. There were joint naval maneuvers between Russia and Iran last week. There are a lot of things. These are so many multi-layer.
Should the United States' response to the attack on the base in Iraq been stronger?
I think all along our responses to the attacks against us, and there have been scores of them over the years, has to be escalated. Again, nobody, they don't want to have an all-out war. The American presence there was meant to strengthen the government. The government of Iraq should be doing more to limit the Iranian presence and expansion. But they continue to ship weapons through them. But to go to the Russian thing, still look at Syria. Israel's maneuverability in Syria, where Russia has supplied the S-400, the anti-aircraft, they're not using them against Israeli aircraft. They turned over the Syrians, who have not, as you know, there have been thousands of attacks over the years. No Israeli plane, thank God, was taken down. It doesn't mean they don't fire periodically. But you don't see the Russians going after Israel and limiting Israel, even though we've seen an expanded Russian presence in Syria. They picked a side because Israel and America are on the other side with Britain. Hopefully other countries also. You see that Cyprus, British airplanes are using bases in Cyprus, but it's basically the American presence. There are ships in French and other ships in the Red Sea, supposedly opposing the Houthis. We have done, we fired, I think, 800 missiles against them. We've done 25 or 30 missile runs, fire attacks, air attacks against the Houthis. I don't understand how they're still standing. They're nothing. They're peanuts in this whole picture. Yemen is the poorest country in the world. They get the supplies. The Russians were going to supply them with new missiles. They did not. They withdrew, in part because of what Israel did to the port, which crippled that port in Hodeida, which where the Iranians are shipping stuff through. But they seem to have unlimited quantities. They're firing all the time. Thank God they're being taken down. And again, the CENTCOM ships, America's Navy, there are on alert and have been doing a great job. 25 ships have been hit over the years. This has been going on for 7 years in the Red Sea. Is not a yesterday, but their ability and the lethalness of the weapons they're using is increasing all the time. This is part of the Ring of Fire. Right. One could say it's not successful, the Ring of Fire, to the degree that it prevented an attack on Iran, in Iran, or that they can just rely on that to counter Israel.
Two more quick things. None of this is quick because there's so much to talk about, but what do you think of the United Nations clearing 10 aid workers, but actually firing 9 aid workers suspected of cooperating with the terrorists? As legitimate as this reaction is, still, you have to be somewhat surprised.
You know, the Gemara concept of modem and mixas, when you they're starting to acknowledge, first of all, it's 1,000 of the UNRWA, and maybe more, or thousands of UNRWA guys, the UNRWA employees. You know how many employees Nahum UNRWA, which is supposed to serve the Palestinian population, has in the serving the Palestinian, quote, population?
How many?
30,000.
Oh, my God.
30,000. That's more than serve all the refugees in the whole world. Oh, and it's a massive ripoff. And the funds go to the terrorists. And they, as you saw, UNRWA schools have been the cover for a lot of the tunnels, a lot of the operations of Gaza, in Gaza, that they were involved, and they were seen the first day on October 9th involved in the actual attacks, not just in the support system. That 9 is, to me, an important admission of guilt, because they were always denying that UNRWA was involved. But the 9 really should be 900 or 9,000. And it's a massive ripoff, which is part of this massive system where hundreds of millions of dollars a month go to the Palestinian Authority, to Gaza, to the PA itself.
Wow.
Most of it going to line the pockets of the billionaires, including Khaniyeh, who was killed, and the others. Each are estimated to have $5-6 billion. It is so corrupt and so massive, the assistance that they're rendering. So the 9 are symbolic. Let's see what happens to the 9 if they're not just shifted over to some other position.
Yeah.
But admission of guilt is important.
And finally, I can't believe I didn't ask you this over the last couple of weeks, and many listeners have pointed that out to me. Do you think Erdogan and Turkey are serious when he says that he wouldn't put it past his army to invade Israel?
I would not put anything past him, because he is literally insane. And he's capable of doing anything. As you know, I meet him 3 times a year up until the last year or two. We stopped meeting him altogether. I've met him in Turkey. I've met him here in the United States. We sometimes have long discussions, but almost never didn't end up in a fight, because he will say outrageous things. And he will play it for his domestic purposes. It is not a popular position amongst many in Turkey to go after, even though there are demonstrations and stuff. I'm most worried, of course, about the Jewish community in Turkey, which is diminishing all the time. He has been protective of the community there generally, but his assertiveness against Israel, I would never dismiss it. I don't think it's likely that they're going to send troops. He has bigger fish to fry, like in Syria, against the PKK. He wants to occupy part of Syria. Syria doesn't want him there. The Iranians don't want him there. So, all of them are fighting each other. But again, we can't dismiss. He has, he's a member of NATO. He has a powerful, we had the most powerful air force till he fired all of the pilots you know, when he won in the purge after the alleged threat against him, and you know, the loss again in the last elections, he is going to play to the extreme of the population, the Islamist extremist. He's a Muslim Brotherhood guy. He has imposed that ideology. I think many people in Turkey reject it, but no one should dismiss what mischief he could engage in.
Have an easy fast, Mr. Honlein, and a good Shabbos, and we'll speak, please God, next week.
And everybody remember that Nachamu comes after it, so yeah. We have hope.
Important message, something to keep in mind at all times. Malcolm Honlein, weekly update, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, Fridays here at JM in the AM.